consistent. I just really want to indicate that there's a lot of absolutely beautiful, interesting mathematics hidden in the social sciences. That I really would like to encourage mathematicians to get more interested in the social sciences and social scientists to get more involved in some of the mathematical structures which are there. It's a fascinating area. The first lecture I talked in terms of voting paradoxes, showed how these paradoxes tied in with problems from statistics and probability, and how the resolution was not analysis. I'm an analyst. It's not analysis or dynamical systems. That's my area, both my areas. But really from symmetry. Symmetry groups and various things like this. And some chaos, using some ideas from chaos. Second lecture, what we did is we looked at making proposals in departmental meetings and discovered how there the problems cropped up and involved ideas from singularity theory. Last time, what we did is we used evolutionary game theory. We got into dynamical systems and some ideas from algebraic topology, winding numbers, and various things like this. And today I'm going to continue with the dynamical systems, and I'm going to address, like I did all the other times, is introduce the first the social science problem and then show where some of the mathematics is hiding. Really, the problem comes from Adam Smith, one of the oldest or most famous mathematical social scientists. Adam Smith was not an economist. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. He wrote several books in terms of various types of things that moral philosophers write about, including a lot of books on astronomy. At least two on astronomy. And Adam Smith was captured by the work of Isaac Newton, where Isaac Newton took and found the fundamental governing law for physics. He wondered, is it possible to find an underlying simple governing law? And it's going to be greed, law for economics. His underlying law still dictates economics today, whether the economists say, no, we're interested in this or that. Incentive theory and all these others are really based on greed. We call it the rational agent. So what I want to do now is perhaps the most important part of Adam Smith in his book is the word about the invisible hand. And I'm going to show you where that comes from, where the modern description of it is, and why we are nowhere near understanding a thing. First, let's suppose I have C commodities and A agents. Well, we know the problem in R2 or R3. R1, you've got a nice natural ordering of points on there. This one's larger than that one. R2, we don't. Or R3, we don't. There's no net. There's an infinite number of ways to order the points on in a higher dimensional space. We have that curse of dimensionality. And so what we do is, for the kth agent, what we do is we just simply have a mapping from R, whatever my a number of commodities I have, into the reals. And we steal the ordering from the real line or the inverse images. See, what we do here, this line right here, and this line right here, it's the inverse image of the same point, and so these are called the indifference curves. And we're saying, I'm indifferent. If I have so much of this commodity and so much of that, I'm indifferent. I like them just as much. So we get the ordering in the very clever way of taking a mapping from here and looking at the inverse set. Now we introduce prices. Alrighty. So I have the prices P1 and P2, and I'm going to assume no production, just a simple, I'm going to assume the purest, the easiest economic model around. People are just plain exchanging. And so what we have is a person has a certain amount of a commodity, and so we'll say that that's given by this point right here. And what that person does is at the given prices of P1 and P2, that person is going to sell all of his commodities to get some money and then go buy some stuff. Okay, so how much money does he have? Well, it'll be P1 times the amount here, P2 times the amount here, and you add them together. In other words, it's just the dot product. So this is the amount of money in this pretend money that we have. And here is what the person wants to buy. It wants to buy X1 units of the first commodity, X2 units of the second commodity with the same prices. So what the person can buy, that's the cost of what he's going to buy. There's the amount of money the person has. There's the cost. You set them equal, and what we end up with is an equation like this. A very simple equation like this. Orthogonality condition. And let me draw what that means. Here I have my price vector right here. And then I have a line passing through my initial endowment, which is what that's called, which is perpendicular to it. This is called a budget line for obvious reasons. It's what I can afford. It's strictly what I can afford. And so what does what are these current standings of economics? Is they say that, okay, here's what I can afford. Let's let the person optimize. Well, if these functions right here, if these level sets right here tell me how much I like, where more is better, then what we do is we have a constrained optimization problem. Find the best value right here, subject to this constraint. So here is a utility. Here's another utility giving higher happiness, higher utility, and just at its tangency point there. Right at its tangency point there is where I'm optimizing. I can't get anything higher. And so really what we're doing is we're just optimizing right here. Okay, any questions on what I have here? Because I'm going to be using this story a bit, and I want to be sure you understand it. Any questions? Everyone see what happens there? And indeed, the idea is just simply, here's how much money I got, and here's how much I can spend. And when you write it down mathematically, I just get a nice orthogonality condition. That this is what I can afford along this line right here, and I just choose the point which gives me the greatest happiness. And so what is it that I have? Well, let's see. The difference between here and here, between this height, is what I am going to supply, and the difference here is what I demand. So you get your supply and demand right out of that picture. And it really is just the supply and demand is just this, what this person has minus what they have. And that is the supply and demand story. Okay? Everybody with me? Okay. Yeah?
Okay. I would have expected that you would have a reciprocal in there for prices. Like if the
prices are just
eventual utility is dependent on how much stuff you have.
That's right. And in this peer exchange, what we're doing is money is just a means of exchange. It's just a bookkeeping type thing, a means of exchange. And in fact, what happens is that if the prices change, see if the prices change, then what happens is the level set changes. And then that gives you a different different demand structure. And in fact, what we do is we have certain properties that you get right out of here. Here is my, what did I use here? All I used was the orthogonality condition here. So if my prices are all of a sudden jacked up by a factor of 5 or 2 or something like that, lambda, well, the demand, what I'm demanding is going to be precisely the same. The orthogonality condition is the same. Okay, everyone with me there? Because I'm going to be using this condition right here. So it says that really in this story, the only purpose of the price was to give me a direction and to give me my budget line that I'm now going to maximize over. And so therefore, if I change the prices, all of them by the same multiple, I still have the same demand. So in other words, this excess demand function is homogeneous of degree 0. Lambda doesn't matter. And if my preferences are strictly convex, then it is a continuous, then this is continuous also. That's a technical detail. Take my word for it. And the last one, this one right here, is that the price times this right here. Whoops, excuse me. Is that the price times my what I want versus what I'm going to give is equal to 0. That's just a budget line. Okay? So these are very, very simple conditions. So the conditions then that we have in a lot of the economics 101 or type models is you got a level set that gives you my ordering on the space. My price defines what I can afford. And all I'm doing is optimizing. And if you're looking for another example in calculus for a lot of these type things, this is a beautiful different example than what you normally see. And what I do is I just find that point, so where the gradient is going to be pointing in the same direction as that, and I just write it down, and there's the properties. All right, that's the individual demand. What is going to be the group demand? And that's what we get, what is called the aggregate excess demand function. And all it is just a sum of everybody's excess demand. It's just a summation. So she has an aggregate demand. She's going to supply something and demand something, and so is she, and so is she, and so is he. And we add them all together, all of the supplies and all of the demands. And presumably, and we get this thing right here. What are its properties? Well, it inherits all kinds of properties from right here. One of the properties is it's homogeneous. Each of these is homogeneous to degree zero. So this has to be homogeneous to degree zero. It doesn't matter if I'm... The story I like to give about this lambda is I was down and I spent a lot of time, so has Florin, in Recife and Rio and various other places. Boy, they just had unbelievable inflation. And what happens is you see these little street urchins out there selling things. What you do is if they come there today and they know what the value of the zero is and they know what it is tomorrow, they just immediately just scale everything immediately. They have no problems handling all that scaling. It's just a medium of exchange. It doesn't mean anything. And that's really what we're doing here. So here's the homogeneity, continuity, and the orthogonality. Let's see how we can use this as mathematicians. As mathematicians, this right here, it says it doesn't really matter what the price is, just the relative scale of prices. Now, economists normally say, take one price and call it a numeraire. One price, and they say everything else is, how is it relative? We'll take the price for pens, and we'll call that $1, and we'll see how much is everything relative to the price for pens. I don't like to do that. I like geometry. And so I'm going to say that the prices has to equal 1. I want the prices to be on a unit circle. Okay? And so what my prices are going to be is they're going to be on the unit circle inside of a price. So here's a price simplex right here. It just, any point here just gives me what the price is. And this condition right here says what? It says, here's my surface, and it says the excess demand is just a tangent vector field. It's just a vector that's tangent to that unit circle, that sphere, and it just tells you which way prices presumably will be moving. Okay, everybody with me? I want to be sure everyone's with me on this. Okay, so let me quickly repeat down here. What we did is the story for each individual demand is just obvious. You buy what you can buy. Okay. And from that, the prices don't matter. It's just a relative scale of prices. So I'm going to make that on a unit sphere. It's continuous, and this is orthogonality. And I have trouble drawing always a sphere, so I just flatten out my sphere into a triangle. All right. First question. Does Adam Smith's story hold? Presumably Adam Smith's story is that the prices are going to change according to the supply and demand. Isn't that what we read all the time? Pick up the newspaper. We say that we're in an inflationary period, but prices are adjusting according to, etc. Well, either this dynamic or this dynamic here. But we've been told an economic policy is made according to this type of a story. So the first question, there's two stories here, and this was the brilliance of Arrow and DeBrew. They said, number one, let's first see if there is a price equilibrium where supply equals demand. And number two, then we'll worry about the dynamics of how we get there. So let's look at the first part. Does there exist an equilibrium? And Arrow and DeBrew really answer this question by use of, and I'll explain how. Suppose you find out that these pens are free. You want one? Probably about 10 of them or something like that, right? So if the demand If the demand price is zero or close to zero, the demand is going to go up for a desirable commodity. Okay? So what does this mean? It means that my vectors on the boundaries are pointing inwards. Because on the boundaries, that corresponds to where something has zero price. See, here's price 1, price 2, price 3. So if I have this boundary right here, it corresponds where the second commodity costs zero. And here, this corresponds to where the first commodity costs zero, so there's going to be a demand for that first commodity. And here, it's where the third commodity is zero, so there's going to be a demand for that. And the theorem now, the fact that there's an equilibrium now, follows by that winding number thing which we did last time. That if I take this pen and I see how often does it wind, ooh, makes a complete circle. Makes a complete circle as I go around there. That tells me there has to be at least one equilibrium inside of a certain type. So really it was with winding numbers, or more precisely what they used were fixed point theorems. Under what conditions is it that a mapping will have a zero? Fixed point or zero, same thing. Yes?
Sir, why did the price increase inside the triangle? Why is it ever something out?
Why? Oh, I see. Okay. The answer would be the same if it went out, if they all went out. But what happens here is, see this right here, the way the arrows point is if the price is zero, it's going to be pointing in the direction of wanting more of commodity 2. Correct? And so that means it's going to be pointing inwards. And here, if price is 3 is zero, it's going to want more of commodity 3. And so they point inwards. Excellent question. And so that what we have then from fixed point theorems is there has to be at least one equilibrium.
But you also have point 1, point 2, and point 3 being 0, so 1 and point towards those ones as well in this case?
Yeah, but all I want to know is, in other words, you're worrying about the boundary vertices and things like this. Yeah, all I'm interested in, though, is that it's pointing inside.
Okay.
That's all I want. Where exact direction that is continuous and pointing inside, that's all I need. And then from the fixed point theorems, I know that there exists an equilibrium. And in part, Arrow and De Brew got a Nobel Prize for this work. The other part was for their work in voting and social choice, and I will come to that next lecture tomorrow, showing why their theorems do not mean what we've been told they meant for the last half century. Alrighty, so where are we? What we are is at the point where we have an equilibrium exists. But, so we know there exists a price equilibrium. We know there is a spot where a zero where supply equals demand. How do you get there? Pardon?
You may not be able to.
Might not be able to. And in fact, what happens is that if we could get there, if the Adam Smith story, the invisible hand, were correct, it would say that let the market pressures go. And then what we would do is see a contracting to that equilibrium. That would tell you something, that the equilibrium, that there has to be an equilibrium, and that equilibrium has to have certain special properties. So what Sun and Shine did, and I'll give you a couple stories about Sun and Shine while I'm at it. What Sun and Shine did is he said, okay, if Adam Smith's story is correct, then what happens is the aggregate excess demand function has to have other properties. And what Sun and Shine asked is, what other properties? Let's see if we can find all possible properties that this excess demand function has. This is really a theme that goes all the way through economics. What properties do we have in terms of certain economies, etc., like this? And he wanted to find all possible properties. He started working on it and got a special case with use of some of the Weierstrass-type work and things like this. Rolf Mantell, Hugo Sonnenschein, I was an economist. Got his degree, or he's an economist. Got his degree from, I think, Minnesota.
Purdue.
You're right. I was at Purdue Rhythm. How in the hell can I forget that? but what he did is he went to University of Michigan to get to earn essentially a master's degree in mathematics. I don't know if he actually ever got the degree. Went off to Massachusetts, and he did this work when we were colleagues at Northwestern University, is when most of the stuff was published. A lot of it was done a little bit in advance. Then what he did is he got, for his work, he got a Guggenheim fellowship and membership in the National Academy of Sciences. And after that, he went off to a school, small school out east called Princeton, and then became provost at Princeton. And then he sold out to become president at University of Chicago. And now he is back. He's been promoted back into the faculty. So he is a faculty member back at the University of Chicago. But Sun and Shine telling me about some of the results I'm going to show you next is what got me into economics, partially. My statement was, I don't believe it. So let me tell you what he did. Ralph Mantel went along and made an extension of the Sun and Shine, and in the form that I'm going to tell you is Gerard Debreu. They said, let epsilon be greater than zero. In other words, let's stay away from zero prices. So I'm going to look at all prices except for a very, very thin band on that price simplex. So all prices are going to be a little bit larger than epsilon or larger. So I'm going to be inside here. Then he said, the theorem says, choose any function you want. I don't care what function you choose. Any function you want, f of p, which satisfies those three conditions. What are they? Homogeneous of degree zero, right? Scale, change of lambda, doesn't matter. Two, continuous. Three, that it is orthogonal, that's on the tangent vector field, it's on that price simplex, it satisfies the budget plane. And what they said, what they proved, if there's at least as many agents as commodities, then there exists an economy such that the aggregate excess demand and your artificial function that you put together agree for all prices except when you get close to zero. In other words, folks, there are no other properties. There are no other properties. According to received theory, in terms of economics where we are today, it says that there is no reason to believe, no reason whatsoever to believe, that the Adam Smith story is correct. It says, for example, that you can have an equilibrium here. Here's an example. I'll choose a F. I'll choose an F where, and then I'll choose a limit cycle right here, and I'll have it coming out like this. And what does this say? This says I have one equilibrium, but if I'm very, very close to it, but not on it, I'm going to spiral away from it and go towards a limit cycle, and otherwise I'm going to go there. I'll never get close to the equilibrium, even if I start almost on top of it. And the Sun and Shine Mantel Debreu theorem says, yeah, that can happen. In fact, Herb Scarf created an example where this of utility functions where this happens. When I say that there exists an economy such that, what I mean is that for each agent, I can give you a nice, strictly convex utility function. You know, the level sets are real nice behaved. And an initial endowment such that when you go through that story I told you at the beginning, that optimizing story, that the excess demand function you get from that is the weird one you skated right here.
But the utility functions may be different for the different agents?
They will be different for the different agents. And in fact, what this means then is that you can go over, for the economist, you can come over here to the mathematics department, ask somebody, he has a book with the title Chaos in there, so go ask Florin for the worst type of chaos that the mathematicians have discovered so far. In any dimension space you want. And the statement is, we can create a nice economy written using nice utility functions of the type we have in Economics 101, where it has that chaotic behavior. In fact, later, if people are interested after the lecture, I'll show you how to construct examples, which any economist will say, yeah, those are nice, those are natural, easygoing utility functions, but it's as chaotic as you want it to be. Let me see if we, as a mathematician, I'm interested in two things. What in the heck is going on here? Why is this true? And number two, if this is true, what else is true? So to answer those two questions, because Sun and Shine actually was getting a lot of heat for his theorem, saying, yeah, but it's only for highly irregular places, and it really doesn't fit, and et cetera, et cetera. They were wrong. It's really is a robust type result. But let's go back to Adam Smith. Suppose I have someone that's supplying beer, pretzels, and cheese, okay, for a party, something like this. Remember what Adam Smith stated. He stated that the butcher, the baker, and all these things, they're making all their own things and selling them. So I'm going to use exactly his story, where I have three people having essentially producers of these three commodities, and that's it. Suppose I'm at a price right here. Now, what is this beer maker going to want to order? Not any beer. That's for sure. He makes the beer. Nobody has beer to sell to him. He wants either cheese or pretzels. He wants a vector that's somewhere in that direction right there. And what about the pretzel maker? The pretzel maker wants either beer or cheese. So his aggregate, excess demand function is going to be somewhere in this wedge. So this will be the beer wedge. This will be the pretzel wedge. And the cheese person wants some beer or pretzels. It'll be in here. Where in there? I don't know. It depends on their individual preferences. But look, I can draw any vector you want. You give me any vector you want there, and I can draw vectors in those three sectors so their sum is exactly what you want. And so really, an explanation for the Sun and Shine Mantel DeBruijn theorem, quite frankly, goes right back to Adam Smith. But not only does it go, the technical part is to try to show that indeed if I change that price, I can make it whipsaw and do anything you want it to do. So the explanation is not difficult at all, and in fact, the explanation shows you that if A is smaller than C, you can't always construct an example. So first, why? Well, I showed you why. And then the next question is, what else? Well, as a mathematician, I told you from the first lecture, as a mathematician, what I like to do is to take the simple problem, pose it into a mathematical framework, and then say, what else can happen from the mathematic framework? So what is it that we have here? Utility functions is a function space. It's a space of all kinds of functions and then initial endowment. And times A, that's the number of people I have. And what I'm doing is the story I told you on that first slide, where I asked you to be sure that there were any questions, everyone understood it. What that does is it takes a function space and it assigns to it a vector field on the tangent plane. So in other words, dated, you take all the utility functions and it gives you an aggregate excess demand function. And a mathematician writing it like that will say right away, well, is this onto? What is the image of the space? What is the image of this mapping? So first question we teach Calculus 101. Be sure you know the image space. Be sure you know the domain. And so a mathematician is interested in knowing what is the image of this. What happens is, with Sun and Shine, Mantel, and DeBruijn, prove that this is onto. Anything you want can be there. So the mathematician then, namely me, says, well, let's extend this domain. Let's extend it to the price over other subsets. To the vector fields over other subsets. And let me then explain in words what this means. Is it onto here? In other words, what I'm asking is I'm attacking a question of revealed preferences. Speak it in economic terms. If you have the excess demand function, we know from the Sonnenschein, Mantell, and De Broglie that anything you want can be an excess demand function, aggregate excess demand function. But if you have the excess demand, if you know how the economy is wanting to trade back and forth, then if we suppress some commodity, dated, can't use it anymore. Or maybe it's got that funny-smelling cigarette or something like that. Can't trade it anymore. So suppose we suppress a commodity. Then basic idea of revealed preference says we should be able to tell you what that commodity looks like or what the excess demand function looks like now for the new one. For example, if I know what the excess demand function is for bread, fish, and steak, and so I know what is going to be the demand at each price, and then now what we do is we just look at bread and fish, I should be able to determine what is the excess demand function for bread and fish from what it was for the whole thing here. Can we? For the same people, everything else. Can we? And the answer turns out no. The answer turns out there is absolutely no rhyme or reason whatsoever. The theorem that I proved, and then I'll indicate how these theorems are proved, is that put this restriction on the price. You can't have zero prices. Then I state, for bread, fish, and steak, choose any vector field you want. Any vector field you want. Then I say, now let's look at bread and fish. Choose any vector field you want. Then look at bread and steak. Choose any vector field you want. And look at fish and steak, any vector field you want. Anything you want. Any store, any wild store you want. Any. And the theorem is that if I have at least as many agents as the total number of commodities, then I can create a nice economy where all of those things go on. In other words, that mapping that I showed you before is surjective on the larger space. Anything you want can happen. It means, as consequences, it means that I can create an example where for this dynamic right here, everything is well behaved if I have three commodities. But for two commodities, I have chaos. For these two, I have chaotic type behavior. For these two, I have another form of chaotic behavior. And for over here, I have nice. Whatever you want. It says that whatever you want, they can coincide in the same economy. That the economy, just plain, can be horrible. That what you know from the full number of commodities tells you absolutely nothing about what happens for any subset of commodities, what the demand will be. Incidentally, I wrote up an article. The notices of the AMS asked me to write up an article on some of these, and I did in 1995, and it came out in February of 1995. And I started off with the very first thing, stating as I stated here, is that Adam Smith's story in his invisible hand truly has dictated a lot of international financial or national policies. And I said, but it's true. And pointed out, as I'm pointing out to you here, we have no idea whether it's true or not. That paper came out about 3 or 4 days in Mexico before the Mexican president said, trust in the invisible hand, trust in market pressures. So what happened, I heard from Florence Guest of 2 weeks ago and several others down in Mexico, is that that are all sorts of copies of my paper were Xeroxed off and faxed and sent to the president and to the finance minister of Mexico. Now, this was a mathematical paper, talking about the economics, but it was a mathematical paper. Can you just imagine the president or the finance minister opening up and seeing all those symbols and saying, what the hell is this? But they had to hold a conference then down in Mexico that following September, where I went down and explained a lot of the things which I'm explaining to you right here. So you see what the point is. The point is that the problems in the social sciences are far more complex than what we ever expected. How do you prove this theorem? The proof of this theorem turned out to be, I think I lost more than a couple of these strands up here from the proof of this theorem. Because really to prove this theorem, I want to show that I can create a continuous function that has the right properties. Creating a continuous function means that I really want to create just the level sets and that they're attached in the right way. Stated in mathematical terms, I want to create a continuous foliation so that it would have the right properties for all possible subsets. And now, creating smooth foliations, we use something called the Frobenius theorem. But for continuous foliations, you have to use some geometric type tricks to try to pull things off and to show it has the right convexity and the right everything else. Intuition, if I have three commodities, I have a level set, and here is my point. So if I have three commodities, here's where I'm going to select. If I have two commodities, I'm talking about level sets in a completely different portion of the level set. And so I just had to show that I can connect them in the right fashion. Alrighty, so that's where we were. That's where we are. We're in a mess. What we have is that almost anything you want can happen, that the excess demand function, in spite of what you see in the newspaper and everything else, is not well behaved. We have no idea how it's behaved. And it can give rise to the worst type of chaos possible.
Two questions.
Yes and yes.
How? Okay. How dependent is the theorem on, one, the relationship between A and C, and two, the fact that you're dealing with discrete dynamics, difference equation as opposed to the differential equation?
Okay. This part right here has to do with the right-hand side of the differential equation, doesn't it? If I use a differential equation, it's the aggregate excess demand function. It turns out that these results are quite robust. The larger A is, the easier it is to create examples. It becomes very, very easy. The tightest situation is where A equals C. That's the tightest situation. And when A is less than C, the theorem doesn't always hold. But if A is, say, twice C, then it becomes trivial to prove the theorem.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about the other.
Yeah. And now I'm going to get into your next question, which is in terms of the dynamics. What is the dynamics of the excess demand function? We so far have shown that that right-hand side, the excess demand function, is horrible. And so what we have is maybe it's not what you stated right here. Maybe economics is not given by a direct change of the excess demand right here. Maybe what we do is, when we look at the different theories, maybe the change of the prices is some method, some theory, of how the excess demand function modifies these type things. So, quite frankly, the idea of finding convergence, of finding something that will work, became a hot topic. And the first really good paper in this direction came by Steve Smale. What Steve Smale did is he said, well, look. I got a mapping. Well, you write down psi here if you want, the excess demand. But I got a mapping. And if I take that mapping and look at the unit interval, what does it do? It lowers a dimension. It lowers a dimension. It's one dimension less the image if I take the size of it. And he's getting these ideas from differential topology. In fact, he's getting it from Milner's book on differential topology that came out in the late 60s, early 70s. And he said, let's just take this vector, which is from Rn to Rn, and let's divide by its length. And then instead of going to Rn, it's going on to sphere because it has unit length. And so then he states that, okay, then what do we have? We have that if I call this function g of p, I don't want to call it g of p. He says that if I take the inverse image, find all p's that have a certain value. So I have f of p over the norm of f of p is equal to a value c, to a particular vector c. What does the inverse image look like? Well, by the inverse function theorem, if you have the differentiability conditions, it's going to be a line. A closed line. What's a closed line? It's going to be a circle. Or it's going to be a line interval which starts on the boundary, so it could be a circle. Or it could be something that starts here and goes to here, where it terminates on both ends. He also said, but wait a minute. If the term starts here and terminates here, then this vector direction here and here have to be precisely the same, because I'm talking about what is the vector direction. So if these things right here all have different directions on the boundary, then it means that I'm going to start at the boundary and I'm going to terminate at some zero in the interior. So let me go through this again. I take my mapping from Rn to Rn, and I make it into a lower dimensional object just by dividing out by its length. What I have then is at each point I have the direction of the excess demand function. Not the size, but the direction of the excess demand function. And what it states is that if I start by the boundary and then just keep tracing all the points where it keeps the same direction, I'm going to end up at a zero, at a price equilibrium, is what the theorem tells us, by use of some differential topology. And how do you find it? Very simple. You say, here's the path, you differentiate it, and you integrate back again. If you differentiate this, I'm going to have df of g of t, g prime of t, plus lambda f of g of t equals zero, because I'm setting this equal to a constant. And when you go through all the arithmetic, I have g prime is equal to minus lambda df inverse of f of g. Newton's method. And for those of you that are in mathematics, we know that Steve Smale's gotten quite interested in issues of numerical computations, and this was the source where a lot of these things came from. So what we have is that, yes, I do have a computational tool for finding the zeros of the excess demand and a large number of other problems from numerical analysis. The idea is simply that I just follow the path where the direction is the same. The direction of the vector is the same, and it'll terminate. It'll terminate right at a zero. All right. So this solved the computational problem, but it did not solve the economics problem. And so, because it doesn't tell you how prices adjust, which is your question. So Carl Simon and I started asking the question, if you come up with a theory where I have convergence, if you are smart and you come up with a theory for convergence, I don't care what that theory is, you come up with a theory for convergence. Oops, excuse me, this is wrong. P prime equals this right here. So I come up with a theory for convergence, how prices are going to change depending on market pressures. M, I don't know what M is. You know what M is. You just wrote the theory. You're an economist. You wrote the theory. So that's the theory I'm going to use. And the only thing I'm going to assume about M is that when I get to an equilibrium, my process stops. And that is continuous. And what Carl and I want to know is, how much information do we need? Because the information from Smale's globalized Newton just plain is too much for any economic story. Far too much. It says I have to know what is the supply and demand, and I have to know how the supply and demand is going to change with any changes in prices. It's going to blow any economic theory out of the water. And what we showed, and I'm going to give you an abbreviated version, what we showed is that need almost as much as Rith's male. Not quite, almost as much as Rith's male. That any theory you have really is just, it's going to work globally for that holy grail of finding where supply always equals demand in the Adam Smith story. Is going to use so much information that it's unrealistic. Totally unrealistic. Not quite the same amount as male needed, because there we're using some algebraic topology and some index theorems, you know, to reduce the amount of information. But we're not reducing very much. Later, pressed by several people, I then looked at the iterative type process. I said, okay, so I'm going to have adjustment in my prices. And I want to know, can I construct a method? Can I construct a method? A theory. Using economic theory. So in other words, adjustment of the aggregate excess demand, just as you were asking. Can I find a theory which modifies the excess demand and uses the first derivative all the way up to the kth derivative? I'll throw in a lot of information, as much as you want. And ask, does it converge? And the answer is no. Therefore, once you get to discrete rather than continuous, and continuous uses an infinite amount of information, once you get to discrete, it says that any amount of derivatives, finite amount of derivatives you use, I can find an open set of economies and an open set of initial conditions where this never converges. In fact, it never even gets close to an equilibrium. Well, think. If I have something and it looks like it's a cycle and it's going back, I'll just kick it a little bit at that end, you know? Just give it a little kick. All right? So maybe what I need to do is have some time delay. So put in as much time delays as you want, as much finite amount of information as you want. As much as you want. And the same theorem states there does not exist a method. There does not exist a method where I will get convergence. Yeah.
They're saying there exist economies where that non-convergence.
Open set of economies. So, in other words, I have an economy and it's not just an isolated example. You can adjust it and everything goes wrong.
Okay. But it does not say that for all economies.
No, not for all. Because we know there are a lot of economies where just P equals psi of P will work, gross substitute models and things like this. But I'm saying that, and really it turns out that for most that you're going to have trouble.
Is it true that for most?
Yeah, for most.
You can.
And it turns out for most you have troubles. So really what we have, all of these things right here just carry over to numerical analysis, etc. Hey, if you're trying to find a zero, it's numerical analysis, and this all applies to numerical analysis. The same theorems. And in fact, in numerical analysis, we know that there are theorems that say, if the function has such and such properties, then this will work. But this says, globally, we're in trouble. So I want to conclude by, in some sense, saying that, yeah, darn it, I got negative results here. Do I believe these results? Absolutely. The results are mine, a lot of them. Most of them are mine, so yeah, I believe them. Okay, I believe the mathematics. I don't believe that's the way economies behave. So what's the challenge? The challenge is to try to find out what kinds of hidden assumptions. Remember, a lot of my other lectures were about hidden assumptions. What other kinds of hidden assumptions are inside there which are causing this distorted effect? In my opinion, there's a lot of deep mathematics hiding inside there, just waiting to be with a team of mathematicians and economists to try to extract. For example, one of my students and I showed that maybe I can cover my space of economies with a pile of methods. Can I find a pile of methods? Where for this economy, use this method. For this economy, use this method. In Brazil, use this method. in London use this method, in Paris use this method, in Victoria use this method. And we were getting positive results, but we have no idea what these methods are. So this is a covering. It's a covering of the space of utility functions. Are there mathematical challenges in the social sciences? There's some very deep ones. And so and the conclusions run counter to what a lot of the economists normally believe. I encourage, again, as I did last time, all the mathematicians to get interested in some of the issues of the social sciences and the social scientists to get involved with some of the mathematical structures. Tomorrow I will show how Arrow's theorem does not mean what Arrow said it means. And Sen's theorem does not mean what Sen said it meant. And a lot of these other classical results do not mean what we've been told they mean for the last half century. With that, I thank you.
Well, thanks, Don, for your very nice talk. So let's take a couple of questions.
You mentioned growth substitutes.
Yeah.
And getting at sufficient conditions for equilibrium.
Yeah.
I know a student on a conference asked the question, when the demand curves slope downwards, and he said everywhere where they don't slope upwards. And you permitted demand curves to slope upwards. And by extension, the excess demand functions, aggregate excess demand functions will also be badly behaved.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, can you redo those similar results with gross?
Yeah, growth substitutes turn out to be an open set, very, very small open set of economies. Let me give you an idea of what the utility functions look like for the Sonnenschein, Mantel, DeBrew. Now, first let's start with, if you take a look in a lot of economics journals, you see some of them, and I'm going to use this as a contrast. In a lot of economics journals, what we do is we, mainly, maybe because it's easier to analyze and draw, we have utility functions like this, right? Flat utility functions. And that is precisely how you get the worst type of, the absolutely worst type of economic examples if we use the exact type of utility functions that the economists have in Econometrica, JET, and various other places. They're not weird utility functions that give rise to this pathological behavior. They are precisely the kind that you find in economics journal. What happens on, how does you get the demand function spinning around? The way the demand function spins around is that all of a sudden I want to have a lot of beer, and then my demand for beer goes down, but my for cheese goes up, and so it just causes this type of a thing to go around. And not hard at all to grow it. In fact, John Ledyard, when I was at Northwestern, John Ledyard, a group of us, created a bidding game, double auction bidding game, where instead of an equilibrium, you would get into a cycle. And when each person had their own data of how they're going to, much they're going to earn, very, very nice data. And it spun around, we couldn't get to the equilibrium. And Charlie Plott at Caltech has been running experiments of this type, showing that not only do you get these things theoretically, but you find them with experiments. And people got their data, and they're busy trying to jump ahead and trying to screw thy neighbor, and you still get it.
So you do require this convexity condition, which agrees with intuition, and you do require continuity, but you don't require smoothness.
Mm-mm.
Does the theory change if you require smoothness?
It's easier to prove the theorem.
And but you have fewer functions to choose from.
Yeah, fewer functions to choose from, but it turns out to be much easier to prove the theorem.
So it's an analogous theory.
Oh, yes. And in fact, Ivar Eklund, you know, from Paris, who is now, I learned, in Vancouver, has proved a theorem with smoothness of type of things like this, which was the Sonnenschein-Mantel, not my extension, but the Sonnenschein-Mantel-DeBrew type thing. The challenge is that the economists were busily dismissing some of the theorems because they had smoothness. And so, therefore, DeBrew proved you could do it with continuity, and then I proved you could get all these extensions with continuity.
Yeah, but it's a different problem. It's
right. Very different problem.
Do it with continuous functions or degrees.
Right. It's really, there's some embedded smoothness even with continuity by the condition of strict convexity. So there's some embedded smoothness hiding in there. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Just trying to understand the assumptions that lie behind Theorem 3, and your point about there could be hidden assumptions. Mm-hmm. Is it true that you're imposing that the method be constant across all primes?
All right, let me tell you where the problem crops up. One of the key themes in economics, in fact, in the social sciences, is a rational agent. A rational agent is one who's going to try to maximize, according to that picture that I drew, you know, in the first lecture. Well, let me ask you the following. Exactly how much money do you have? I mean, right down to the penny.
$25.
I have no idea how much I have or anything. And most people don't. All right? But what the rational agent theory states is it states that here I am at this point, here is the price, and over here is the utility function right here. It's right here. Okay? And then if the price has changed so much as a penny, well, what happens is I can create the utility function that my demand is going to do whip way over here. It's going to be flat demands, but it's going to whip way over here. And change everything a penny more, and it's going to whip all the way over here. My contention is that the rational agent story is used incorrectly. We know what we want, but when we use it mathematically, we're throwing on blinders, a myopic approach.
Indeed.
And once you say that you can replace this, and I did this in a paper about 3-4 years ago, that I'm going to replace it, I don't know the exact endowment, and I don't know the exact price, and I'm taking a probability measure over here, and then going through the supply and demand story. Then the Sunshine Mantel to Proof Theorem no longer holds. And it's extreme. It still is bad, but not in its extreme. And my theorem doesn't hold in its extreme, but it holds essentially. The dynamics theorems, they still hold. I couldn't get rid of them. So this is one direction that I'm looking at to try to get rid of these assumptions. What are the assumptions that the economists are looking at? Here's what they mean. Here's what they're doing. And is what they're doing emasculating what they want? And a lot of times it does.
But I would argue to some extent that the representing the agent just as an excess demand function understates the rationality of the agent in the sense that the agent in the economy is not just someone with an excess demand function. Think of the seller selling beer. They have someone trying to sell beer as opposed to having an excess supply function of beer. Yeah. That's a very different thing.
Right. But the point is, what he's doing is he was saying, for the mathematicians, is he's stating that a lot of these models, when we start getting into them, they're far more complex. And we have agents and various other things like this. What I'm contending is that you don't get the total extremes. I already showed you how to get rid of some of the total extremes of Sunshine, Mantel, and DeBrew. But the message is, and this I can't get rid of, even in the models that you state, the message is aggregation, whether it's probability, statistics, economics, in terms of excess demands or other things, gives you a lot of things that we don't want to have. And it is far more complex than any of us had ever anticipated. And we still don't know the full magnitude of it. And I got to quit because we got to have on here.
Well, thank you.